I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about a topic. Wow, is this a topic in the news? It is in the news every day, has been in the news for a number of years, but in particular since 2020. We're going to be talking about America's anti-discrimination regime, talking about the law, the politics, the history of anti-discrimination in the United States. It's a topic that elicits a lot of heat, unfortunately, not always as much light. That's why I'm so glad we have our guest with us today, a very thoughtful scholar of anti-discrimination in the United States, who will shed some light for us today on the fundamental issues involved. That's Professor Tom Powers. Tom is professor of political science at Carthage College and also a chair of the Department of Political Science at Carthage. Tom is an eminent, a wonderful teacher and an eminent scholar on America's anti-discrimination laws, history, and tradition. He has a wonderful book out that I want to recommend to all of our listeners called American Multiculturalism and the Anti-Discrimination Regime, The Challenge to Liberal Pluralism. It's a very thoughtful, engaging, well-written book that deals with the issues, both the contemporary issues and the history of how we got to where we are today when we're talking about things like colorblind law, DEI, affirmative action, multiculturalism, all those hot button issues that are with us today. Tom sheds light on all of them in a way that you'll find accessible and really illuminating. So let me highly recommend his book, American Multiculturalism and the Anti-Discrimination Regime. And I know he's working on a project we were just talking about. He's working on a new project on civil rights education, especially civic education in the law of civil rights, which in fact occupies an important part of his book and a whole chapter in his book. What is the law in America about civil rights? If you've ever wondered that about that question, Tom's going to be working on a project. So listeners out there who want to help Tom in that project, please get in contact with him at Carthage College. Tom Powers, welcome, my friend, my old friend, my graduate school friend, to The American Idea.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very, very happy to be here.
All right, the anti-discrimination regime, it's kind of a fancy name. It's kind of a big name. It's kind of a political science-y name. As you know, not all of our listeners are political science professors by any means. We have citizens, we have students, we have teachers. Boil that down for us. What do you mean by America's anti-discrimination regime?
Well, that's a great question. I use the word regime, and it is a provocative term, and I explicitly advance an Aristotelian regime approach to political science in the book, which may seem strange to some of your listeners, but the idea there is something that we in America, in a way, we resist because we're the products of the liberal tradition, which is a universal theory of politics, beginning with claims about individual rights and individual freedoms, and then from there builds up a whole structure of, you know, how the state should operate in our Constitution. And that is a very healthy and powerful way of looking at politics, but it does obscure the question of who rules. In a way, liberalism says nobody rules, everybody rules, and we have institutions of representation and protections of the individual against oppression and tyranny and so on. And as I said, that's all very healthy because regimes can be quite problematic because a regime is some part of the community that is running the whole show. And the ancients, they just assumed that was the essential question to ask in politics. Aristotle, Plato, that understanding of political science is where they start from. And in the Enlightenment, that understanding of things got sort of brushed away. And I'm a defender of liberalism. In a way, my whole book is an attempt to sort of show how the civil rights revolution is challenging those liberal democratic assumptions that come out of the Enlightenment by advancing what we have to call a kind of regime, because there is a set of groups in America who are represented by anti-discrimination politics. That is not a mystery, right? You talk about racial minorities, women, LGBT folks, the disabled, like it's all codified in the law. So it's not like a hidden agenda or something. It's very, very out in the open. But this, it turns out, has a kind of disruptive force in politics, and not just the groups, it's the kinds of claims they're making in political life that are not consistent with our liberal democratic tradition. And I focus in the book a lot on multicultural education and multiculturalism, which goes takes us back to the 1970s, because that was a very early civil rights initiative. And there you do see the radical ambitions of this new project, because multiculturalism is simultaneously a new civic education. It's also a new pluralism, or an articulation of group politics that is not the same as liberal pluralism. So that's the subtitle of my book, The Challenge to Liberal Pluralism. You see very clearly in the arguments of people who advocate multiculturalism and multicultural education in the United States. And it's also a new political psychology, a new political morality. And so it is quite helpful in illuminating. I mean, multicultural education, the downside is it's kind of obscure. It's a subfield of teacher education, doesn't get a lot of respect. It's not like critical race theory, you know, where everybody sort of is up in arms about it, partly because it's so old, but it is very illuminating of the radical ambition. Oh, and the word regime, I think you have to start to take seriously then, because this thing is very ambitious in a way that we're not used to seeing. We never saw that with labor politics, and never saw that with the New Deal, but somehow the civil rights revolution really is making big claims. If you have a new civic education and a new morality and a new pluralism in your country, something has changed.
That sounds really big. Now, if I and certainly our listeners think about civil rights, our minds immediately go back to the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, people like Martin Luther King Jr. And they would say, well, look, the civil rights movement was about freeing, especially African Americans, from the manacles of segregation, from the manacles of racism, and to fulfill the American dreams, the kind of language that King uses, for example, in the I Have a Dream speech, right? The original understanding, it seems like, of the civil rights movement, at least in the early 60s, was we want everyone to be treated the same, the content of their character, not the color of their skin.
Yeah.
We want people to be treated as free individuals who are equal with everyone else before the law.
Sure, and that is certainly...
Is that the 1960s civil rights ethos?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right to say that. And that is the way in which the civil rights revolution comes out of the liberal tradition, for sure. But at a certain moment, it goes beyond it. And for me and others, you know, now I think increasingly people are saying that the 1964 Civil Rights Act did do something. And I there are sort of two sides of my book. One is about the law in the first few chapters, and then the bulk of the book is about the new pluralism and some of the ideas and the way we think about politics as a result of the civil rights revolution. But if I can just talk about the law.
Yeah, I was going to say, take us to the law. Take us to this really, really monumental watershed law, the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Yeah. So before 1964, in a way, what you are articulating is a vision of civil rights that says, you know, there's something wrong here in America where African Americans are being denied equal citizenship. They're being denied equal protection of the law. And that was very clear. And I have a whole chapter on that. And my chapter two is all about that, to show why the civil rights revolution was necessary. But in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and this was something that people did worry about when it happened, the Kennedy administration did express reservations about going into the private sector in Title II and Title VII. Barry Goldwater, this was the number one domestic policy issue of his campaign against Lyndon Johnson, was the Title II and Title VII. Title II deals with hotels, restaurants, public accommodations, we call them, but they're private sector, you know, gas stations, cinemas. And then Title VII deals with private employment. And so Barry Goldwater and others did express concerns about that. But once the 64 Act passed, there was no turning back. And the basic achievement of the 64 Act, I think anybody would say today, is sensible. Like, and it was immediately successful and not particularly controversial, right? The signs went up, or signs came down that said, you know, no African-Americans allowed in this restaurant or whatever. And they came down, and that was the end of it, pretty much. Almost overnight, that succeeded. Same with employment. But then other changes immediately started happening. So affirmative action, what we today call disparate impact, a different way of looking at discrimination that says, not just overt acts of like, you're fired because you're Black, or I'm not going to hire you because you're African-American or a woman or whatever. Not just those overt acts, but also any inequality that's out there that we can see between groups, we're going to suspect that there's discrimination. There was a Supreme Court decision in 1971 affirming that understanding of things. And it's the beginning of a long train of a law that's called disparate impact that today is alive and well. That was the first big change. And then there were others that came a bit later when discrimination, which is never defined, oddly enough, in the law, became redefined as or expanded to include things like stereotypes and harassment and the idea of hostile environment harassment. And then other changes, and this all happened in the 1990s, and I spell this out in my chapter three, liability change, which sounds very boring, but it's really important because in the workplace, this is all Title VII employment discrimination law, corporations became responsible not just for their own actions when it came to hiring and firing, but anything that happened in the workplace, or anything not even in the workplace, but like what contractors were doing or what customers were doing. The sphere of the workplace really expanded, and their responsibility expanded for harassment, hostile environment. So what's that mean? I mean, that can mean any offensive statement. It originally, you know, if you look through the law, originally offensive statement was sort of the Supreme Court said, no, well, we don't mean that. But eventually EEOC said, yeah, that is what we mean. So offensive statements, imagine how broad a category that is. And corporations now can be sued for anybody in their environment. So they became very paranoid. They asked the courts, hey, you got to give us some way to protect ourselves. And then the answer came back, okay, you have to take preventive and corrective measures. And there's something called the Ehlers-Barriger test that nobody knows about. This is why we need a civil rights civic education. But the Supreme Court said you must take preventive measures and you must take corrective measures. Well, what does that mean? Preventive measures became diversity training. And there's even a Supreme Court decision about that, Kolstad versus American Dental. No one knows about this, but I suspect very few people know about that one. But, you know, that stands for diversity training, the educational mission of anti-discrimination law. And then there's also corrective measures. What does that mean? Well, the EEOC eventually spelled it out very clearly. You fire people who are causing trouble, right? So the workplace became a civic educator and a police force. And this is never spelled out by statute. It happened in Supreme Court decisions, EEOC directives that are not very well known. And so we just think there's something going on we call wokeness today, right? But it is anchored in the law very clearly when you look for it.
So that's fascinating to me, because what you're saying is the story seems to be the original impulse is, again, sort of liberal in the sense of the old-fashioned liberal tradition of free individuals who have the right to work, for example, without being interfered with, have the right to be treated equally before the law. And over time, through bureaucracy and court decisions, the Title 64 Civil Rights Act is really meant to enshrine that idea. But over time, it becomes very quickly identified with, well, you're not an individual, you're a member of a certain group, like a racial group or a gender group or whatever it is. And bureaucracies see it as their goal to equalize the outcomes that members of these various groups achieve. And they start holding workplaces, corporations, et cetera, accountable for achieving those outcomes.
Yeah. And also, you know, harassment and disparate impact are two separate things. And I do want to emphasize that, because I tend to resist the tendency, because, you know, I've been writing about this forever. And so affirmative action was always the predominant issue, but there were these other things going on around harassment. And so, you know, what we today call wokeness, people getting in your business, telling you how to think and what to say, censorship, all of those issues, those are also there too. And it's a little different from just group equality, right? It's somehow a new moral teaching, which we find, unsettling, because it includes things like don't have any sexual stereotypes, like don't believe in men and women or something like that. And so that can go very far. That's probably one of the most radical things that's come out of the Civil Rights Revolution is just our new understanding of sex and gender, right? Which you get to right away as soon as you say stereotypes are wrong. That's an amazingly radical step. There's sort of two sides of it, group equality and then these other moral teachings, I think you have to call them, that come right. And this is, again, one reason to think there's something going on here that is like a new political order at the heart of things that's generating this change, a number of changes in how we think and how we live and how we deal with one another. It's very, very...
This. So, that's a fascinating idea. If this new regime and new order has been over time making progress, I think some of our listeners will wonder, okay, is it intentional? Are there people thinking this through and saying, yeah, this is the direction we want things to go? Or did it just happen one step at a time, unintentionally, from one move to the next move to the next move?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you're absolutely right to suggest that it was not intentional. You know, most of the important, most is probably wrong, but a number of the most important decisions that were, because the Supreme Court, Congress didn't act on this. Now, the 1991 Civil Rights Act did indirectly endorse some of these changes, but only indirectly, like it would kind of weigh in on things in a weird, odd way. But really, it was the Supreme Court was the body that gave the final approval of most of these changes, like harassment, for instance. But guess who wrote the first harassment decision? Rehnquist. He, and then Justice O'Connor wrote the next one that clarified, the standard of harassment. And then the Ellert-Farragher test was, one of those two Supreme Court opinions was written by Justice Kennedy. Justice Kennedy, of course, is very famous for his stance on gay rights. Justice Scalia actually played a role in here in a case extending these harassment and stereotype protections to LGBT folks. Gorsuch, most recently in the Bostock decision, extended all of Title VII in a way to LGBT folks. Sex discrimination now covers LGBT folks. So the expansions of the civil rights regime, yeah, I think you have to say no one was in charge. No, and no one in 1964 saw that any of this was going to be coming, but there's something about the morality, I think you have to say, the sort of moral spirit, the spirit of the laws. We're in this odd territory where the political order is in charge, and it has a kind of logic of its own, and it also inspires a certain kind of radicalism on the left, where people inspired, if you think about it, of course, gays and lesbians, bisexual, transgender folks existed, women existed, disabled people existed before 1964, but they changed their self-understanding, I think. Many people did, many members of those groups did, because the Civil Rights Revolution, in a way, gave them a new way of seeing themselves. And that radicalized many people in those groups, or at least some considerable portion of those groups, so that they became carriers. They started thinking, how can we push this further and further and further? So the idea of harassment, for instance, comes from Catherine MacKinnon, a very famous feminist law professor. And she's as far out on the left as you could imagine, but then her idea was adopted by William Rehnquist. What does that mean? I don't know. That's sort of a mystery.
That's fascinating, because it means that what you really have, the engine, the legal engine of this, as you're describing it, this new regime, is Supreme Court decisions interpreting the Civil Rights Act. That's been the way that these things have been put into practice in law.
Well, that's at the sort of the tail end of something that happens in an interplay between the EEOC is probably the most important engine.
Our listeners, remind us what that means.
The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the main enforcement arm of Title VII, employment discrimination. And I mean, thousands of court cases or discrimination cases go to them every year. So they're deciding all these cases all the time. So they're having, and the EEOC is a commission. They have authority to make various kinds of decisions. And they're also pushing for lawsuits. So they shape the law themselves a great deal in Title VII. Title VII, I think, we tend to think constitutional law is the most important area of law. for the civil rights revolution, constitutional law is actually gives you a very distorted understanding of everything. I started out as a con law professor, and so I was actually influenced by this myself. I used to think, well, start with the Equal Protection Clause, the 14th Amendment, but that's all public sector. It doesn't tell you anything about Title VII or Title IX, which deal with, you know, universities and the workplace. And when you start reading those opinions, you see conservatives taking very, what look like kind of left-wing positions, whereas in constitutional law, the conservatives actually have held the line on, to some degree anyway, with some exceptions. And so it's possible to see, if you look at constitutional law, oh, conservatives are always holding. No, if you look at the statute, forget about it. Title IX and Title VII, that's just not true there. And, you know, I don't have a broad, like, explanation for that dichotomy, but it is a fact. And I think the simple explanation is, when you get into one of these cases, the morality behind it pushes people. Like, you see a case of outrageous harassment, you're like, well, that doesn't look good. We don't like that around here, you know? And so something like that, as simple as that, it's the moral basis of these legal changes that has driven people. But then people are not seeing the broader consequences. And we are starting to see them now. And there is pushback now. And I think the changes we've started to see in the last 4 or 5 years are going to take hold and are going to have some effect. But that's
a question I wanted to ask. First of all, I think that's a really interesting point. I'm thinking about folks who might be listening who are teachers who say, I want my kids to understand anti-discrimination in the United States. And one of the things you're saying is, don't just study the Supreme Court and constitutional decisions.
Yeah.
Study the Civil Rights Act and study the court's the EEOC's interpretation of it. Study the court's decisions on those things, because that's really the driver of it. So to me, that's fascinating. I think that's a really important insight.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to note was, you said that, and I think this is really surprising for me to hear, that woke didn't just happen in 2020 or 2019 with the 1619 Project or something.
Yeah.
This, whatever wokeness exactly means, it was already in the soil of the anti-discrimination regime, and for various reasons took hold and blossomed more fully in the last 5 to 10 years. Can you tell us a little bit more about how wokeness was already in the regime that started developing after the 1960s?
Yeah, I mean, I would probably go back to the 1990s and the early 2000s when things like diversity training really took hold in the workplace, and then changes in Title IX also happened about the, you know, maybe a couple of years later. There was a little bit of a delay, maybe. But yeah, I mean, a very aggressive campaign of civic education coming out of these institutions. It was sort of haphazard. And I read a lot of, you know, law review literature and sociology of law by folks on the left, and they're always disappointed in these changes. They're always like, oh, diversity training doesn't work. You know, it doesn't succeed to the extent that we want. But when you read what they say about it, it's amazing. There's a woman, I think Susan Sturm is her name, and she had this whole theory of how changes in the workplace represented a new kind of Republican government, like, you know, the managerialization of law and so on. I can't remember. I might be mixing her phrases up with other folks. They were really celebrating this as a way of getting at and sort of governing the minds, you know, to some degree, the social interactions of people, using the power of our fellow citizens, because there's nobody who comes to your door wearing a EEOC hat, right? They're the HR guy or the HR gal down the hall who says, hey, you know, we got this complaint about you, and we need to have an investigation of it. And all of those changes were, you know, 1998 is the Ehlers-Berger test. That's the end of a long development of both harassment law and liability changes. So you can say, okay, that's where the Supreme Court gave its blessing to this arrangement. And then immediately you find lawyers telling all these big corporations, all right, you guys have got to start doing this or else. And you also see big dollar legal settlements, you know, Wall Street firms and others with sexual harassment really took off at about that time in the mid 90s, actually. So it was already happening earlier. But then the combination of the legal framework, which said, hey, take preventive and corrective measures, and the incentive not to be sued and all the reputational damage. All of that was in place. And then in the universities, a much more aggressive framework was put in place because they didn't like the Title VII liability restrictions. So the Department of Education, and this is Shep Melnick's wonderful book, The Transformation of Title IX, he spells out how the Department of Education took a much firmer hand and started launching investigations of whole universities based on a single harassment claim, hostile environment, a hostile educational environment claim. They would launch an investigation in the entire university. No university president wanted that. So everybody was immediately jumping up and doing whatever they had to within the university sphere. And the university is easier to control than a corporation. There's probably more flexibility in terms of what you can do and how aggressive you can be, professors and administrators and universities are more sympathetic to the broad goals of the civil rights regime. So they were willing to do this. And so what took place in the universities was even more aggressive. So for 20 years, we had this growing policing of our society, which included censorship. You could get fired for saying the wrong thing, right? So that's a very kind of clear censorship in a way that's taking place in this bizarre indirect way through the background of the law, but it is directly related to the law. And that's probably the most important form of censorship that comes out of the civil rights movement. And then people getting fired also, right? So it's a punitive regime, censorious and moralistic. It's telling people what they ought to think and who's right and who's wrong in a very direct way. And people, people partly go along with that, but people also resent it. And so I would say wokeness really kicked off, and I'm almost done. I know that's a long answer, but about 2015, after the gay rights, gay marriage decisions, there was an uptick in wokeness, right? So, and I think there was a kind of injection of energy into the civil rights revolution again after those gay rights decisions, sort of like Brown versus the Board of Education, because you have the Supreme Court saying, hey, all our laws are wrong on gay marriage. And then you have trans rights kind of kicking off. The Me Too movement happened in 2017. So there were some big things happening before 2020. And then, but 2020, of course, was another upsurge. And so, 20 years of broad development, 2015 kicked it up even higher. 2020 kicked it up even higher than that. But then after 2020, there's been pushback now in a new way. And I think this is unprecedented, actually, our current moment.
So that's fascinating to me. I'm just thinking of, you say how important that became in the culture of corporations and companies and the workplace. Maybe some of our listeners, I certainly am a fan of the show The Office. And one of the very first episodes of The Office is called Diversity Day. And it's a comedic interpretation of that kind of regime, actually. Yeah. But both on the one hand sympathetic, but on the other hand, kind of quietly critical as well. Sure. Of the regime. All right, Tom.
Hey, if I can make one cultural reference.
Of course.
The uprise of woke, I would point to the arrival of PC Principal on South Park in 2015. So that is, I think, that's where I date the recent upheaval to South Park.
To an episode of South Park. Fair enough. Tom, all right. I think a lot of our listeners are wondering, all right, so wokeness is not a new phenomenon, but it certainly has gone in different directions following the gay rights, gay marriage decision in 2015. You mentioned trans rights. What's the future of the anti-discrimination regime? You mentioned that there's been pushback against it. And in part, there's been pushback against the whole idea. In part, there's been a kind of pushback. Interestingly, now some groups pitted against each other who had been previously allies in the anti-discrimination regime. For example, right? Women, including some feminists, saying, hey, wait a minute, the whole trans thing, like men competing in women's sports, should we be in favor of that if we're feminists? Should we be against that if we're feminists? And you're hearing a lot of pushback, even within folks who would broadly be sympathetic to each other, saying, well, it's a contradiction. If you have group identity, you don't get to define yourself as an individual, as a member of that group, unless that group says it's okay. Where do we see the state in the next, say, decade of the anti-discrimination regime?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important question. And I mean, you're right. There are divisions on the left that are sort of emerging The one you mentioned is very important. But I think the most important thing is actually the reaction on the right is people are finally, Christopher Caldwell's book, The Age of Entitlement, made some of the arguments I'm making about the Civil Rights Act. You know, his book came out, I can't remember, it was 2018. So it was a while ago, well before mine came out. But that was well received on the right. And he was saying some things that were pretty controversial at the time. There have been a lot of other books that have come out since that have taken a aim at wokeness. Some of them emphasize the law. Most of them don't. And I have to say, here I'm a little nervous because Christopher Rufo, his executive order, Trump's executive order taking aim at what we call divisive concepts. And there are many states that have actually adopted laws like that since. That was, in my opinion, the beginning of the war on woke was that moment. Because I don't know if you know the story. Rufo went on Tucker Carlson and he said, Mr. President, you know, you should root out this use of critical race theory in the executive, in the federal government's diversity training. And the next day, Trump, the White House called him and said, hey, come and write this executive order, which he did. And that was a real change because it was taking direct aim at something that had to do with anti-discrimination enforcement for the first time. Efforts prior to that, going back to about 2015, all had to do with free speech. So you have, FIRE, which had actually been around since 1998, very important institution fighting for free speech, and the Chicago Principles, I think, were 2014 to 2015, and other free speech efforts kind of popped up and became important around 2015. But Rufo's executive order is, as I understand it, the first time anti-discrimination enforcement itself became the issue, and there have been other efforts in that vein in the last couple of years. Right now, there are many laws against DEI, which in a way is a vague category, but they're important because they are going after DEI offices. And so these are the enforcers of civil rights law, although, again, that gets very tricky because the laws, the state laws that have been passed to deal with this, all fail. We don't mean Title IX, we don't mean Title VII. So anyway, it's a bit of a mess, but there's a change. There's a new energy, and also the Supreme Court's affirmative action decision, which has been followed up in the corporate sector as well. The affirmative action decision of 2023 dealt with higher ed, but it's also been, there have been some victories in the courts in the workplace on affirmative action. So there is a broad reaction now that it seems to me has a new energy and a broader focus than any time in the past. In the past, it's been mainly dealing with free speech issues and affirmative action. It's bigger than that now. Now, as I said, people don't yet quite see that what they're doing is they're advocating for civil rights enforcement reform. And I think that's what has to happen. Instead, Rufo has a book out where he blames Marxism, you know, Herbert Marcuse, neo-Marxism. And I think that's a distraction and a mistake, actually, and an important one, because you're telling people that what we're up against is Marxism. And we already beat them in the Cold War, so good for us. It's going to be easy this time around. And, you know, there is, I have a chapter in my book on postmodernism. I don't talk about, I have some footnotes on Herbert Marcuse and these folks. If I were to rewrite the book right now, I guess I probably have to have a chapter on Herbert Marcuse, sort of battle that back a little bit. So I'm not so sure how much conservatives know what they're doing, I have to say, but they are doing something and they are pushing back in a bigger and broader way. And there's a lot of energy around it. And so I do think these changes will have some effect. A lot depends on the 2024 election. If Trump is elected, people have been talking about Rufo becoming Secretary of Education. I think that is actually a possibility. And he would be very aggressive, you know, in a role like that. And I think in general, conservatives are going to be aggressive on these issues if Trump wins. And then that would be White House, Supreme Court, and about a good 22 red states all battling this stuff. And that would mean that a number of changes would have been made by the end of Trump's time in office, where you would have the beginning of a new battle.
You could end up, with the right pushback, as you say, doesn't mean that folks making those arguments will win the day, but they'll push back enough so that the country will be legally divided as it now is divided in opinion.
That's, That's actually a really good way of putting it. And that's not necessarily good. I mean, I wish, that's why I want this civic education. I mean, I have this idea of a civil rights civic education project to kind of give folks a better understanding of what we're dealing with. The civil rights revolution was good. I think we have to say that, you know, the articulation of it that you gave at the beginning of the show, you know, indicates why it was important and why we ought to be in favor of it. But something went off the rails at a certain point, and we have to, and it's very hard to draw lines like that. Well, this goes too far, that doesn't. But one thing we have that we can refer back to is our liberal democratic tradition, which is very wary of moralistic utopianism. And civil rights politics is a kind of moralistic utopianism. And you see that, that's one thing you really see with multicultural education and in the latter chapters of my book, where you get this new kind of very ambitious moral reform is somehow underlying the civil rights revolution or its left interpretation.
Fascinating. Wow, what an interesting subject this is. I feel like we're just scratching the surface of what's going to be clearly an important election issue. It's going to be an important political issue, legal issue, social issue, educational issue. Tom, I think you've really raised some important questions for us to think about today. Thank you again for taking the time to join us today. Again, our guest is Professor Tom Powers. His book, American Multiculturalism and the Anti-Discrimination Regime. Take a look at it. Tom, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.